Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The clerk will call this morning's calendar.
Calendar for the Supreme Court of California holding session in San Francisco on Tuesday, May 25th, 2004 at 9 a.m. is as follows. Case number S122923, Bill Lockyer, Attorney General Petitioner, be the City and County of San Francisco Respondent, Nancy Alfaro as County Clerk Respondent, Gavin Newsom as Mayor Respondent, Mabel Tang as County Assessor Respondent. Case number S122865, Barbara Lewis et al. Petitioners, be Nancy Alfaro as County Clerk Respondent. For Petitioner Lockyer, Mr. Muscat. For Petitioners Lewis, Mr. Lawrence. For Respondents, Ms. Stewart. Case number S067491, In re Ronald Harold Seaton on habeas corpus. For the petitioner, Mr. Myers.
Ready, Your Honor.
And for the respondent, Mr. Mulford.
We'll hear first on behalf of Petitioner Lockyer from Mr. Muscat.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Tim Muscat on behalf of the petitioner, California Attorney General Bill Lockyer. Your Honors, this case this morning is not about the constitutionality of prohibiting same-sex marriage in California, nor are these proceedings a referendum on the policy issues surrounding these proposed unions. Instead, the Attorney General filed this petition in order to prevent local officials in San Francisco from continuing their past practice of issuing thousands of unauthorized state marriage licenses. This petition should be granted for one straightforward reason. In California, public officials do not have authority to grant licenses when they do not have the power to grant such.
Now, is that the case in all instances in terms of a general inability to take into account constitutional considerations in enforcing a state statute, or are there exceptions to any broad prohibition on that?
We would submit that there are no exceptions, Your Honor, and there certainly wouldn't be an exception in this case when the state authority is clear. Here the authority derives only from the California Family Code. Under Family Code Section 350, it is local clerks that have the authority to issue state marriage licenses.
But would you acknowledge that there are instances where the law may not be clear, or there may be a constitutional question or conflicting statutes where a local official might have to exercise his or her discretion in deciding whether or not to enforce a state statute?
Your Honor, under the scenario where we have here, where there is no controlling state authority or federal authority, there certainly is no federal cases or state cases that have questioned or challenged the California Family Code's definition of marriage. Certainly, there may be hypotheticals where there is a Ninth Circuit decision or there is a California appellate court decision where a local official would have a stronger argument that he or she could violate state statutes.
Certainly, there are the bond cases the city relies upon where perhaps the only way of bringing into question the constitutionality of a statute is for an official not to enforce it in order to bring the matter before the court. Would that be one illustration?
Your Honor, that could be, but what's important to consider in those cases is you still had judicial actions. The authority of the city to challenge the bond still ended up before the courts, and that's not what happened here. Here we had city officials, in defiance of clear state laws, deciding for themselves, based on their own subjective concerns of the Constitution, that they are not only going to not enforce an existing statute, but they're going to go one step further. They're going to effectively rewrite the statute and implement a statutory scheme that does not exist.
But, Council, does Article 3, Section 3.5 apply to local officials?
Your Honor, under the facts of this case, we strongly argue that it does. Here you have local officials that are acting as arms of the state. And we make that argument for three reasons. One, they are implementing a state law. They're not operating under federal law, and they're not operating under any local ordinance. Two, in the implementation of that state law, they are ministerial officials. They have absolutely no discretion. The definition of marriage is clear, and all the parties agree that there is an opposite sex requirement under state law today.
But did that proposition brought about Article 3, Section 3.5, did it change the then state of the law in California with regard to that subject?
Yes, Your Honor, with regard to administrative agencies. And what we would submit that in the context of this case, when local officials are implementing state laws, they are acting as agents of the state, and therefore they are the same as administrative agencies.
How can a local official be an agency within the meaning of the state constitution?
Your Honor, the answer to that question, one would have to focus on the law that they're implementing. If you had a local official that was operating under a local ordinance, then that would be an entirely separate matter. But that is not the case here. Here under the California Family Code, it just happens that the authority has been delegated to a local official. But the authority itself is clear. The authority is the California Family Code.
So sometimes one is an agent or an agency, and sometimes one is not. The same person might be under some circumstances and not under others. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, that certainly may be the case. And in other cases, when this Court's developing Article 3, Section 3.5, it may ultimately reach that conclusion. But for purposes of this case, where you have the local official that is implementing the state law and actually issuing a state license, we believe that the matter is clear that Article 3, Section 3.5 does apply, and the local officials cannot declare the existing state statute.
So is the administrative agency the Department of Health Services in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is the administrative agency, as referred to in Article 3, Section 3.5, the Department of Health Services in this case?
The Department of Health Services, Your Honor, has ultimate supervision over the assessor and recorder when the recorder is acting as the local registrar, actually filing the state licenses. And we submit that the local registrar has to follow the orders that are given by the department. And in this case, the department actually issued a cease and desist letter instructing the local registrar to stop filing marriage licenses that did not comply with state law.
So were the local officials acting as agents of the Department of Health Services in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that's a fair characterization.
Mr. Muscat, does the Attorney General's argument depend on whether or not Section 3.5 applies?
No, Your Honor. We think that there are two broader reasons why the local officials could not do what they did in this case. First off, they simply had no authority. The only authority, again, that they possessed derives from the California Family Code, and that is the only definition of marriage in the state of California. And absent any authority, they cannot implement a scheme that's broader than the definition of marriage in the California Family Code. Now, we appreciate the argument that they've made, that they have constitutional concerns about this statute. But we believe that it's ultimately a question of judicial power and judicial authority. That authority properly rests within the judicial system of California.
So, Mr. Muscat, what, in your view, should have happened in this particular case? The term you used was judicial power, so I presume your argument is that relief should have first been sought through the courts. But I'd like to hear from you specifically what action you think should have been brought.
If the local officials believed that the state statutes were unconstitutional, they could have brought a declaratory relief action.
Ah, I'd like to stop you right there. I need some help from you on that issue. I wonder if a declaratory relief action could properly have been brought. On what basis would the city officials have standing?
Your Honor, under the case Central Delta Water Agency versus State Water Resources Central Board, the citation is 17 Cal App 4621, we submit that if a political division of the state of California can challenge the constitutionality of a state statute on behalf of its constituents, if it believes that the constituents' rights are inextricably bound with the subdivision's duties. Certainly under that context, the subdivision would have standing, and our office certainly would not challenge standing under those situations.
And further questions on the propriety of a declaratory relief action, other than wondering who the defendant would be in such an action, would it be the health department? Would it be the Attorney General's office? Apart from that, don't you need a controversy in order to bring a declaratory relief action? And what exactly was the controversy at issue here?
In this case, Your Honor, the controversy certainly could have been the clerk receiving orders from the mayor to not fulfill her ministerial duties under the California Family Code. She would be faced with a conflict. And
but don't we have to look at what happened before the order of the mayor to this particular clerk? Looking at that time, there doesn't appear any actual controversy with any identifiable parties on either side.
Your Honor, we think that there ultimately would be private parties who would be stepping up, demanding to have what they would perceive as their equal rights treated with appropriate dignity by the state of California. And so it simply wouldn't be the clerk, but you would have parties who would have an actual injury or a claimed actual injury, and that would be your standing as well.
Isn't that what happened in these other states, such as Hawaii, Vermont, and Massachusetts?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Where individuals saw fit to resort to the judicial system to challenge the validity of statutes that restricted their rights to obtain marriage licenses.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe
that's
correct.
But then that is, of course, and I agree with the comment that persons who have been denied marriage licenses because of sexual orientation could indeed bring their own challenges. My question was directed to you that here the city officials could have brought a declaratory relief action. And on that point, I wanted some input from you. But I certainly would agree that it would have been entirely proper for persons who have been denied marriage licenses to bring an action in court.
Mr. Muscat.
Yes, Your Honor.
If we agree with your argument that the mayor had no authority to direct the registrar to effectuate these marriages, would that not be the end of the case, or do I understand that the Attorney General is asking us, in addition, to invalidate the marriages that have already taken place?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Let me continue and say, in light of that request, what authority does the Attorney General have to bring the issue of the validity of the marriages before the court when the parties affected by those marriages are not before the court?
Your Honor, we submit that under the definition of marriage, that these unions simply fall outside of the definition as indicated in Family Code Section 300 and 301.
Does that mean they are void?
No, Your Honor, we submit that the marriages are invalid.
Could you explain to me the difference between invalid and void?
Invalid, under the context of where how we're using it, Your Honor, means that these unions never had any legal effect whatsoever. We're certainly not trying to bring under the Family Code an independent action to declare these unions void or voidable, which is certainly permissible under the code. What we're submitting is that under the state of the law, they go beyond the definition of marriage, and regardless of the fact that there was the issuance of a license, that there was a ceremony, and that they were recorded, they simply have no legal bearing under the California Family Code, that they simply have never existed.
As I understood the question, it also went to the Attorney General's authority or standing. I take it from your briefs that you rely in part upon the constitutional duty of the Attorney General to make sure that state laws are uniformly applied and that you also represent state agencies such as the Department of Health that are affected by and that issue regulations pertaining to the issuance of marriage certificates. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of sheer judicial economy, it makes a great deal of sense to deal with the issue of these 4,000 licenses. There's going to be a great deal of litigation if this court doesn't address that issue. Without question, the parties who receive these licenses are going to attempt to assert their rights in a variety of different contexts involving government, involving businesses, and these third parties are entitled to know what sort of rights and obligations these unions should receive and how they should treat the people who have received these licenses.
In addition to the rights of third parties, don't you have the problem of the rights between the individuals?
Your Honor, the people who have received these licenses are going to face a very difficult choice come January 1, 2005, when the latest version of the domestic partnership statute comes into effect. Because if you are married, you cannot qualify as a domestic partner. And so we certainly think that even the individuals who've received these licenses, we appreciate that some probably would rather have uncertainty, but a lot of other people probably want to know what their rights are and whether they should become domestic partners.
But that is supposition, and those individuals of whom you speak have not had the opportunity to express their views on that.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the ultimate question of the definition of marriage and its scope is a legal one. And there was really no need for a factual record to be built in regard to individual people who have received these licenses. It wouldn't change the legal definition.
So you don't feel that any principles of indispensable parties or joinder or due process are applicable here?
There's no due process here, Your Honor, because the institutions and the licenses that were given fall outside the scope of marriage. No due process right can be created when you have no right to begin with. And here, while everyone has the right to marry, they can only get married if they meet the prerequisites under the California Family Code.
If ultimately, and this is not the question before this court, but if ultimately it were to be determined by this court or another court that the statutes limiting marriage to a man and a woman are unconstitutional, would not the marriages that have occurred be valid?
No, Your Honor, because it is ultimately a exercise of judicial power to reach that conclusion, and that authority would come into being when a court declares it. And until that happens, the right does not exist.
Counsel, were the applicants for these licenses advised that the ultimate marriages may prove to be were of indeterminate validity?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the forms that they received that were presented to them by the local officials, they were advised that this license may not have any effect outside of the city and county of the state of California.
I understand, was the city performing marriages during this period of both same-sex and opposite-sex couples?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so different applications were provided to those who appeared to be of same-sex?
Different applications were provided and different forms were used for registering the unions, Your Honor.
So the city shouldn't have any difficulty in providing notice to those who were married under the same-sex license procedure?
It certainly should not, Your Honor.
Mr. Muscat, as far as Family Code Section 308.5, adopted by Prop 22, is it necessary for this court to address the breadth of that statute as to whether or not it applies only to out-of-state marriages versus in-state marriages?
Your Honor, that is an open question, and it need not be resolved by this court. The definition of marriage and the opposite-sex requirement for marriage exists also in Family Code Section 300 and 301. So other issues regarding the breadth of 308.5 need not be addressed today.
Counsel, if we were to disagree with you that Article 3, Section 3.5 does not apply to local officials, does that mean you lose, or do you have other arguments to support your position?
Two other arguments, Your Honor. The second argument is there is still a separation of powers problem in this case. As we've briefed, here you have local officials that are simultaneously exercising judicial, executive, and legislative powers. The core legislative power that they're exercising is the policy question regarding the definition of marriage. The core judicial power that they're exercising is not only are they making the judicial determination that the existing statutes are unconstitutional, they're also then taking the next step and implementing the judicial remedy of what it's going to believe.
Counselor, don't cities make these kinds of preliminary constitutional determinations all the time with respect to issuance of, say, parade licenses or news rack ordinances and other things at a local level? They make a determination whether or not something's constitutional or unconstitutional, do they not?
Certainly not to this degree, Your Honor. Again, because what the city officials have done is, this is not a scenario where an executive decides that he or she is not going to enforce a statute because they have constitutional concerns. Here we have local officials that have decided they're going to effectively rewrite the statute. They believe the statute is unconstitutional, and they're then going to implement the remedy for that constitutional violation. Under this scenario, the legislature is left absolutely powerless. It's not as if the California legislature can reenact Family Code Section 300 and say we really mean it this time. Their core authority has completely been taken away by these local officials in San Francisco, and it's because you have an invasion of a core legislative power and judicial power that you have a violation of the separation of powers clause here. I'd also like to reassert on the question of judicial authority. When you look at what happened in the states of Vermont and Massachusetts, even when the state Supreme Courts declared that there were constitutional violations in regard to their existing state statutes, clerks in those states were not automatically given the authority to issue state licenses. In both cases, you had the state Supreme Courts deferring the judgment in order to give the legislature a chance to address those constitutional concerns. And that is the fundamental problem we have when local officials and not judges make these decisions. San Francisco showed absolutely no judicial restraint. They did not defer to the statutes and presume that they were constitutional. They presumed that they were unconstitutional and automatically granted a remedy and left the legislature and this bench out of the question.
Mr. Muscat, to follow up on a question that Justice Chin asked you, assuming, solely for the purposes of oral argument, that we were to disagree with you on your heavy reliance on 3.5 or whatever the number of the section is, the constitutional provision at issue. Are there certain cases from this court that, in your view, support your view, or your position, rather?
Your Honor, though your time is up, you may respond to Justice Kennard's question, Mr. Muscat.
Thank you, Your Honor. Under the Strumsky opinion, we would certainly argue that even if this court agreed with San Francisco's argument that the separation of powers clause does not apply to local officials, it doesn't entirely answer the question, because the ultimate question still becomes, what authority are you exercising? And here we submit that the judicial power is held exclusively by the courts, the legislative power is held by the legislature, and local officials cannot exercise those powers.
Thank you, Mr. Muscat.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. We'll now hear on behalf of petitioners Lewis et al. From Mr. Lawrence.
May it please the Court. One additional reason that I would add just to elucidate why San Francisco did not have the authority to do what it did was the principle of express preemption on a matter of statewide concern. I think the Attorney General was alluding to this, but I just want to bring this out a little bit more. I do not think this Court needs to reach the issue of Article 3, Section 3.5 to resolve this. I think it could do it on that grounds. But the problem with the logic that that San Francisco has put forward is that it assumes that these statutes are unconstitutional and then makes a rather large leap to say, and therefore it has the authority to rewrite the state statutes the way that they think, the city thinks it should be.
Mr. Lawrence.
Yes.
You just mentioned, as you started your oral argument, Section 3.5, and I'm sure you must have heard my question to the Attorney General on that particular issue. As you may recall, it was a follow-up question to the one asked by Justice Chin. If we were to hold that 3.5 doesn't apply here, what do you think, based upon case law from this court, is on your side?
The case law are the various cases that say that local units of government cannot exercise authority in matters of statewide concern. Because if the marriage laws are unconstitutional, and I don't think there's one particular one that says that, the city has all the authority it has to deal with marriage licenses come from the statutes. So if the statutes are unconstitutional, they have authority to do nothing. They can't say, we are going to act like the legislature and fix the problems that they have. Because what they're essentially saying then is that this matter of domestic relations law is not a matter for the legislature, it's a matter for county and local government to decide. And you're going to have a balkanization of family law, domestic law, where each county or city can decide, well, we don't agree what San Francisco did. We're going to keep with the current laws, or no, we're kind of, we think polygamists are.
Well, as I understand it, though, the city's argument is not that there isn't statewide preemption, but that the statute providing for statewide scheme is unconstitutional and therefore need not be applied. I don't think the city has taken the position that each city or county can determine for itself what the marriage laws are, provided the marriage laws are constitutional, but that rather in the absence of a constitutional scheme, the city is free to act as it did.
Well, Chief Justice George, they are not, they haven't written those words in their brief, but I think that's essentially what their argument is. Because if the statutes are unconstitutional, then where does their authority come from to issue these licenses? It's not Family Code 355 or 359, because those are unconstitutional, so they have no authority to do anything rather than rewrite it. And so I think the logical extension of what they're saying is that county government has the authority to decide domestic relations law however it wants, if they deem the laws to be unconstitutional.
Council, what do you say to the argument, though, that under 3.5, assuming that the city is an agency, administrative agency, that the Federal Supremacy Clause supersedes that and that the state constitutional provision itself would be unconstitutional?
Well, I think that that is a possible legal situation that this court could confront one day. But it is not here in this case that this dilemma that San Francisco says that it faces between following federal constitutional law or state constitutional law and the marriage laws is simply not there. In the brief, the city of San Francisco is very selective in what it talks about and ignores significant cases that contradict that there's this federal trend. For example, when the United States Supreme Court dismissed the appeal in the Minnesota Supreme Court's case of Baker versus Nelson. Under Supreme Court rules, that is a decision on the merits reached below. The Minnesota Supreme Court said the questions presented in the jurisdictional statement was whether it violates federal right of privacy under the Ninth Amendment, whether it violates substantive due process, whether it violates federal equal protection. And even though the Supreme Court has done away with its jurisdictional statement appeal procedure, it is still good law that needs to be recognized. Now, the Minnesota Supreme Court, if we needed any more clarification, rejected every one of those major federal constitutional claims, even saying the institution of marriage as a union of man and woman uniquely involving the procreation and rearing of children within a family is as old as the book of Genesis. Now, this is the current state of the federal law.
That's a 1971 case?
Yes, it is. Lawrence v. Texas, which possibly could be addressing that, the majority said that this case does not involve whether the government must give formal recognition to any relationship that homosexual persons seek to enter. And Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion, which prophesied that this might happen, does not override Baker versus Nelson. So the trend that they're discerning is certainly not coming from the Supreme Court. Even if we look to the state courts, San Francisco ignored cases which rejected the federal claims from the Arizona Court of Appeals last summer, from the Washington Court of Appeals, the Kentucky Court of Appeals, and the highest court in the District of Columbia. It ignored important facts, for example, in the Vermont case, which is also called Baker, but it's different than the Minnesota case.
Mr. Lawrence,
yes.
You mentioned Baker versus Nelson, and I think
yes.
It is an important case. That's why I would like to take you back. I would like some more clarification from you
yes.
on the importance of that case as you see it, you briefly mentioned to the court that in that 1971 case,
yes,
the Minnesota Supreme Court,
yes,
held that the ban against
it was a same-sex couple applied,
yes,
for a license
and
was turned down.
The state ban against such marriages was proper.
Yes.
And aside from going through the technicalities, because I agree with you that at that point in time,
yes,
that decision by the Minnesota High Court was appealable to the United States Supreme Court. And I gather from your description that the United States Supreme Court dismissed the case. So for all intents and purposes, that decision was a decision on the merits. Is that correct to say?
Yes, it is, because it was a jurisdictional statement rather than a cert petition. And so when they dismiss an appeal for want of a substantial federal question, it's a ruling on the merits raised in the documents brought to the
and
court.
As I understand your argument, based upon your heavy reliance on Baker versus Nelson and this determination by the United States Supreme Court, your argument is that there is indeed a binding decision of the United States Supreme Court, not just the Supreme Court of Minnesota, that a same-sex marriage prohibition does not violate the federal Constitution. And I further presume, in listening to your comments, answers to the question posed by the Chief Justice, that the Baker versus Nelson decision is, from your standpoint, a complete answer to the city's argument under the federal constitution and the supremacy clause, because I gather that the city acknowledges or concedes that it must abide by judicial determinations on constitutional questions.
Yes, but I think there's more than that to it. What the city of San Francisco is saying is that they're discerning this trend. They don't talk about Baker versus Nelson. They don't talk about the cases from Arizona, Kentucky, D.C., Washington, all appellate decisions that reject their opinion. They fail to talk about, in Baker versus State, the Vermont case, where it clearly rejected important aspects of the argument that it made. It said, for example, the Vermont Supreme Court, same-sex couples are not a suspect class under the 14th Amendment for equal protection purposes.
How about, again,
yes,
on Baker versus Nelson?
Yes, Justice Kennard.
I can see the argument on the other side that would say, well, yes, that happened in Baker versus Nelson, but there is newer authority from the High Court in Lawrence versus Texas, and the argument could be made that that has quite significantly undermined the earlier decision in Baker. What is your response?
Well,
to that?
I think it evaporates upon examination. Lawrence v. Texas, like I said, states that this case does not involve whether the government must give formal recognition to any relationship that homosexual persons seek to enter. San Francisco relies on Justice Scalia's dire prediction in the dissenting opinion that this is going to end up be the result of it. But Lawrence v. Texas is talking about a private relationship, not formal legal recognition of the relationship, which, you know, is as opposed to criminal prosecution for private activity. So I don't think that they stand in the same place. And these other cases that I have mentioned from Kentucky and Washington, Vermont, et cetera, all reject the federal appeal, the federal issues, and that they have reinforced Baker v. Nelson. So this isn't some antique court decision that is of limited continuing viability.
So one last question on this issue.
Yes, Justice Kennard.
Would it be correct to say that your argument can be summarized then as follows, given your reliance on Baker v. Nelson, that yes, there are later decisions. More significantly, there is a decision by the High Court in Lawrence versus Texas that came down just last year. But if I understand your argument correctly. There is nothing to indicate that any decisions by the High Court following the Baker case have so undermined Baker that a lower court, much less a public official, could disregard it.
I totally agree with that, and I think that not only Baker but all the other decisions basically add to a chorus that say there is not a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And so that although there could be one day a dilemma that a local government would face between implementing a state law and obeying a federal court decision, a Supreme Court decision, that simply doesn't exist here. The city also ignores the fact that if we're looking at the constitutional trend, the decisions in favor of same-sex marriage in Hawaii and Alaska were overridden by the people by state constitutional amendments. So if we look at not just the more narrow judicial decisions on this issue, but the broader, what is the constitutional law, Alaska and Hawaii, the people overrode the decision of those courts. So they are of no indication of a trend, or their indication of a trend that the people may overrule a court with a constitutional amendment if they say there's a right to same-sex marriage. Nevada and Nebraska have also adopted similar state constitutional amendments. So the point that I'm bringing this all up for is to say this dilemma that San Francisco says it faced of having to obey the state law or obey the Constitution of federal or state simply didn't exist. And on the state level, I want to point out, rather than going through every provision of the state constitution that could apply, Justice Stanley Mosk, writing for six justices in 1988 in Eldon versus Sheldon, a case that San Francisco cites in its brief, said this: spouses receive special consideration from the state. Marriage is accorded this degree of dignity and recognition that the joining of the man and the woman in marriage is at once the most socially productive and individually fulfilling relationship that one can enjoy in the course of a lifetime. Our emphasis on the state's interest in promoting the marriage relationship is not based on anachronistic notions of morality. The policy favoring marriage is rooted in the necessity of providing an institutional basis for defining the fundamental relational rights and responsibilities of persons in an organized society. Now, San Francisco was aware of this and yet still concludes that there's this trend that it must obey and not follow the state marriage statutes. The trend simply doesn't exist, that there was no dilemma that it was put in that it needed to not enforce the laws, let alone rewrite the marriage statutes according to the ways that they think are correct.
Mr. Lawrence, let me say for purposes of argument that we might agree with you that the mayor and the marriage registrar had no authority, were without authority,
yes,
to do what they did. Let me turn your attention to an issue I raised earlier about the status of the marriages that were performed,
yes,
and which, according to your view, we would declare were unauthorized.
Yes.
Would you explain to me why it is not necessary or appropriate for this court to have before it the persons affected by any declaration of invalidity before deciding that they are invalid, and why it wouldn't be better, perhaps, to wait until the ultimate question, the constitutional question, is decided as to whether such marriages are constitutionally required?
I think there's several responses, Justice Werdegar, and I want to acknowledge the great emotions that have been expressed by the couples. We saw them, everyone saw them on TV, etc. But this was essentially an act of disobedience, and there was not a reasonable expectation, as the Ninth Circuit and others have required, for there to be a property interest in the license that would trigger due process. There was the disclaimer that the clerk put on to the applications of the licenses, indicating, hey, everybody, I want you to know these things are of dubious validity. That the officials in San Francisco realized that what they were going to do was on thin ice in terms of its validity. With these, you also make it then dependent on how quickly someone can get into court and get a court to issue some sort of stay or injunction or whatever. And if this court comes with a decision that says something like, San Francisco, don't do this anymore, you lacked authority, but we're going to not deal with the question of the validity of the licenses, you are going to send a message that other counties can do this and get away with it, or at least push off to some future date. Now, if we were talking about something like...
Well, excuse me, if this court were to say that there was no authority to do it, I don't think that any other county would believe they had authority to do it. So that part of your argument, I think, doesn't exactly stand up.
Your Honor, I hope you would be right, but San Francisco, I think, has shown a disregard for the law, and in fact, as they express this as that they're doing civil disobedience against Proposition 22 and the voters of the people here and the laws, that there is an attitude that these can be defied. And I would not be confident, and I express to this court, I would not be confident that other counties would abide by that. But I think it would indicate if you start issuing licenses, the courts are not going to invalidate them. So you're going to give incentive for other counties to do the same thing.
Possibly with other statutes.
Yes, with other statutes as well, land use permits on the coast. If somebody says, we're officials and believe that this violates property rights not to allow people to build on the beach and hand them out, and there's some sort of writ of mandate procedure to stop it, then you have all these individuals say, hey, I've got a property interest in this structure that I've built on the beach or something like that. Every one of these has the exact same legal question. Did the all the licenses that were issued? And rather than having these come up in piecemeal fashions and myriad different cases involving workers' comp or state taxes or whatever as they interface with federal and state laws, this court can do like the court did in Oregon and say, we are going to handle the validity or the invalidity of these as one package. And they're all valid or they're all not valid in one package rather than individually dealing with them, because there's not facts that could be brought forth that would be different. The same-sex couples clearly do not comply with the statutes, and the county clearly didn't have the authority to issue these licenses in the first place.
But how about the argument that was made before, or the comment that was made by I believe Justice Werdiger earlier in the proceeding? What about the due process rights of these couples who are not before this court, and you're asking us to invalidate their marriages? I'd like to hear from you, is there no due process violation?
No, there's no due process violation, and I would cite specifically, and this is in our brief, the Ninth Circuit's decision in Stiesberg versus State of California, which is 80 F3rd 353, and I'm reading at 356. There has to be a reasonable expectation in the validity of the license before due process is triggered. And here, there simply was not. These things were a nullity from the beginning. Nothing happened when San Francisco issued these licenses. They were not, in terms of the law, that they did not have legal effect. The disclaimer was placed upon them. The mayor was proclaiming, this is an act of civil disobedience. I'm disagreeing with President Bush's support of the Federal Marriage Amendment at the State of the Union address. All of that. This was on TV everywhere. Everyone knew that this was making a statement as opposed to, oh, we really think we're getting valid licenses when we go down to City Hall to get this.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. Your time is up.
Thank you.
On behalf of the City and County of San Francisco, we'll hear now from Ms. Stewart.
May it please the Court. Ray Stewart, Chief Deputy City Attorney for Respondents, City and County of San Francisco, the Mayor, the County Clerk, and the Assessor. There's a time-honored rule that has governed our constitutional democracy from the time that it began, and Judge Easterbrook put it this way. All public officials owe their allegiance to the Constitution first, federal laws second, and state laws third.
Ms. Stewart, I do want to ask you, with regard to your position, which as applying that general statement here, you feel gives the officials of the city of and county of San Francisco the right to disregard the state statute because of their belief that it's unconstitutional. Would your position be the same if we had before us the sheriff or the chief of police declining to enforce gun control laws in the city of San Francisco, state statutes, out of a belief that they violated the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms, or whether we employ the example that Mr. Lawrence gave about environmental or planning laws perhaps being viewed as a denial of due process, the taking of property without due process, the takings without just compensation, or perhaps a local official deciding that the state domestic partnership laws, and specifically the new one going into effect this coming January 1st, were invalid because they were an amendment to the initiative Proposition 22, Defense of Marriage Act, that violated the state constitutional requirement of having to have electoral approval of an amendment or repeal. In any of those other scenarios, wouldn't your same approach justify that type of disregard of a state statute?
Generally, the answer, Your Honor, is yes. There could be a limiting principle, which I'll mention in a moment, but before I do, the first two examples that you gave involved the sheriff and I think the district attorney. Those are two officials and the only ones I'm aware of where the courts have on occasion held that they act as state agents because they are directly overseen in certain of their responsibilities, primarily investigatory and prosecutorial functions, by the Attorney General. There's no similar relationship here. There's no state official who, under state constitutional law, oversees the county clerk or any of the other officials that the court gave in its hypothetical. So with that exception, I would say the answer is yes. The limiting principle is this. Here, the court doesn't have to get so far as to hold that in every circumstance a local official can hold or can determine that the law is unconstitutional in applying their functions and in carrying out their duties. Because here, there was strong and judicial support for, or sound judicial authority for, the position that the mayor and the county clerk took.
When you mentioned strong judicial authority, I wonder if you would be kind enough to be more specific.
Yes,
would you mention the cases and indicate from which court they are?
Yes, Your Honor. And let me go back because my counsel on the other side mentioned the Baker versus Nelson case and go to that case and bring us forward quickly. The Baker versus Nelson case was, as he indicated, a dismissal for want of a substantial federal question in a case out of the Minnesota Supreme Court. It was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1971. In 1978, the United States Supreme Court addressed one of the issues that was similar to the one that arose in that case, which was due process and marriage, in a case called Zablocki versus Redhale. That case involved a challenge to a Wisconsin statute which prevented anyone who was behind in their child support from getting married. And the court in the United States Supreme Court held there is a due process fundamental right to marriage. Subsequently, this court, the United States Supreme Court, decided the Bowers decision in 1986. And at that time, I would say the state of the law fairly would not have been in the direction of same-sex marriage being a constitutional right. However, in 1996, the United States Supreme Court issued a decision in Romer versus Evans, for the first time recognizing equal protection rights on the part of gay men and lesbians, and holding that a statute that attempted to prevent, or a constitutional initiative actually, that attempted to prevent gay men and lesbians from getting local legislatures and state legislatures to adopt anti-discrimination laws was unconstitutional and violated equal protection rights. But more recently, and most significantly, in 2003, the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in the Lawrence versus Texas case. Lawrence unequivocally overruled Bowers versus Hardwick.
Also, can you cite language in the Lawrence case where the High Court of the country specifically said we are hereby overruling our earlier decision in Baker versus Nelson?
No, Your Honor, I cannot. What I can tell the court, however, is that there are subsequent decisions, or rather, I'm sorry, Court of Appeal decisions, Tenafly and Licata's, which have are out of the courts of appeal that have held that it doesn't require a direct overruling for a decision that is a dismissal for want of substantial federal question to become no longer good binding authority on lower tribunals and on government officials. In other words, if there is substantial undermining of a case like that, it does not have precedential value any longer.
But you may recall that when I questioned Mr. Lawrence, is it Lawrence?
That's
correct. On this issue, Mr. Lawrence pointed out that, yes, he acknowledged the existence of Lawrence versus Texas, but he also pointed out to the court that, in his view, there are no later decisions, including the Lawrence decision, that have so undermined Baker as to allow a lower court, much less a public official, to disregard it. In other words, as I understand the position that Mr. Lawrence presented, Baker, in his view, defines federal constitutional law on this particular point until the United States Supreme Court says otherwise, which it clearly hasn't done yet.
Your Honor, I disagree on both points that Mr. Lawrence argued. The first is that it requires a direct overruling by the Supreme Court to make a decision in which it issued no opinion but simply dismissed for lack of a substantial federal question, no longer binding precedent. And again, I would cite the court to two cases that we brought to the court's attention in our most recent letter of supplemental authorities, Licates versus Justice of the Peace. It's a Third Circuit case, 637 F. 2nd, 898, and it holds that when there have been subsequent doctrinal developments that undermine the holding necessarily made in a summary dismissal, the lower courts are no longer bound. And that we also cited a case called Tanafly, which is another Third Circuit case, more recent one, 309 F. 3rd, 144. But secondly, I disagree that the Lawrence versus Texas decision does not provide substantial support for ruling that, combined, by the way, with the Zablocki case, the Romer case, and others, for overruling the holding to the extent there was one in Minnesota in Baker versus Nelson.
Ms. Stewart, let me ask you a question. As I understand the argument that you're making, once the constitutionality of a statute becomes in question or its validity becomes vulnerable, you are arguing, I believe, that a local official has the authority in good conscience, if that's the case, to act in contravention to that statute on the basis that it is unconstitutional. If I have correctly stated your argument, I would ask you, what limits do you put on the authority of a local official? And we do have this scenario of local officials up and down the state having different views of this matter. What limits would you, how would you circumvent that authority?
Your Honor, there are two. One is that I do think that a local official needs to act in good faith based on judicial authority that is supportive of their position. But secondly, and the most important limit on local officials' authority is the writ of mandate, and that is why we have a writ of mandate. Judicial review is the real limiting principle here. That is to say, the court will
recall... Counsel, let me interrupt you with a hypothetical. The Leno bill was passed out of committee, validating same-sex marriages. Suppose it passed the Assembly, then passed the Senate, and was signed by the governor. Would the mayors throughout the state be free to disregard it?
Your Honor, again, if there was a change in the law such that somebody held that unconstitutional or a decision even short of that that strongly suggested it, there might be a basis for it. But there is no such law, and I don't anticipate that there will be. So, in other words, if it were adopted, perhaps the court would take it up. I assume there will be challenges if it is adopted. But until there's some kind of...
But good faith is not enough.
You know, I don't think the court needs to reach that question here. Quite frankly, I think that here there is no doubt that Lawrence, and I would like to get back to Lawrence because I think that it does do much more than my colleague on the other side suggested. Lawrence
Well, before you go back to Lawrence, if I may interrupt you at this point, Justice Chin just raised a question which I don't think you have quite answered, because then you said, well, I'm going to Lawrence. But I would like to hear from you to follow up on a question by Justice Chin when he wondered whether good faith alone is enough, and you then said, well, you would like to talk about Lawrence. But isn't there something else in addition to good faith that would be necessary before some public official can simply say, I am not going to follow state law, and these are my views of things that are contrary to state law?
Well, Your Honor, what I can tell you is that no court has specifically articulated what that limiting principle is. But in Denman versus Broderick back in 1896, a municipal auditor declined to enforce a statute. In Golden Gate Highway District, that happened again. In both instances, this court said that was acceptable, went on to look at the merits of the question. Even as recently as last year, there was a case before the court, Riverside County, in which the county declined to enforce a state law, which it viewed as unconstitutional. It was a law that required the county to submit labor disputes with sheriffs to binding arbitration. No one in the Attorney General's office came forward and argued that there was some terrible change in or violation of Section 3.5 or separation of powers. Rather, they argued that the county was wrong on its constitutional decision, and this court actually agreed with the county in the end of the day.
Well, I don't understand one thing in terms of what we're talking about, good faith. The city took the initial position very clearly that its views were shaped by the Equal Protection Clause of the state constitution. And, of course, if the city were to be successful along those lines, that would insulate it from review by the United States Supreme Court. Then some of the subsequent briefing seemed to rely instead on the federal constitution, the Supremacy Clause, saying, well, now that we're faced with Article 3, Section 3.5 that may restrict us as local officials and perhaps arguably agencies, that state constitutional provision is itself trumped by the federal constitution, by the federal supremacy clause. So I think there's some conflict here, and I don't quite understand the basis for a shift in reliance on state and federal authorities, especially on the subject that we're talking about here, is a good faith belief as to whether something is or is not unconstitutional that would bind the city officials.
Certainly, Your Honor. Let me address that. I don't think there has been a shift. I think that, as the court is well aware, equal protection and due process are concepts that appear in both the federal and the state constitution. Sometimes the courts interpret them differently. Just as this court will frequently decide a matter as a state constitutional ground and not reach a federal one out of reasons of federalism and respect for the federal government, so a local official may look at that as the first line of concern. However, I think if you read the mayor's declaration, he did rely on both the federal and state constitution, and he basically relied on the concepts of due process and equal protection. He was aware of the Lawrence decision and the other authorities. There is both overlap and not complete overlap in federal and state constitutional precedents. The court can decide an issue, and usually does if it can, on state constitutional grounds before it reaches a federal question. I suggest that that was what the mayor was doing by relying there first, but it didn't mean he wasn't taking into account or didn't care about the Lawrence decision, which, frankly, was a momentous and huge change in the law.
But then one would have to read between the lines, and I won't belabor the point anymore, since you may be running out of time. But assuming that, well, you argue that here the mayor had clear grounds to disagree with the state law in question. What about the argument that we need more than simply, as you have indicated before, good faith? Wouldn't we need, in addition, let me rephrase, wouldn't we also need, in addition to good faith, facts that show that the unconstitutionality of the law in question is just clear on its face? Wouldn't we also need some kind of irreparable harm. Is that present here? Why couldn't this have gone through the courts instead of having been done the way it was? What was the emergency? What was the irreparable harm that was present in this particular case?
Well, Your Honor, to answer the last question first, I think that counsel on the other side actually stated it fairly eloquently. The right to marry is fundamental, and people who are of gay, either gay men or lesbians, have been denied that right for many, many decades now.
But again, why not simply go the route of seeking a judicial decision as other litigants are forced to do? And back on my question of the emergency that the mayor thought was present in this situation, I wonder if you can shed some light on the following, on the issue of emergency. I gather that the California legislature recently passed new legislation, commonly known as AB 205, that will take effect on January 1 of 2005. As I understand it, the legislation gives gay couples basically the very same rights as marriage. Doesn't the existence of this legislation delude any argument that the mayor had to act immediately and nothing could have gone through the courts because it was simply necessary to take action right now?
Your Honor, I don't know which order to answer them in, so I'll take the last one first. AB 205, as the court recognized, doesn't take effect until the earliest in 2005. As the court may be aware, there is legislation already.
When was it passed?
It was passed last year, Your Honor.
What month?
That I could not tell you. I believe my counsel on the other opposing side says October. It doesn't create rights. It didn't create rights for at least 2 years after it was adopted. Moreover, it doesn't come close to making the rights equal, and the legislature recognized that in the findings that it made. It made many changes to the law that will come closer to equality, but it did not go all the way. There are several significant rights and obligations that are omitted from
like what?
205. One is joint tax filing, Your Honor, in state tax. But there are others, and I don't have them all listed. But it goes quite a long way, but in the legislative findings you will see that it does not address every single right. It doesn't cover, and it also doesn't cover, of course, the full range of federal benefits that turn on marriage, much less employment rights that turn on marriage. If the court were to look at the statutes on the books in California alone, there are literally thousands of them that refer to marriage as the predicate for some right or other. There is not a provision of AB 205 that says for all purposes domestic partnerships will be treated as marriages for purposes of state law, much less federal law. But to put the issue more direct to the earlier question the court asked, it will take months or years, first of all, for AB 205 to take effect, but secondly,
wait,
before
wait a minute. I thought that, as I pointed out, the legislation is going to take effect in January of next year. So why would you say it will take several years for this legislation to take effect? I'm a bit puzzled.
At the time that it was adopted, Your Honor, it was 2 years, roughly 2 years. I don't think it was October of last year. I think there was a built-in window of time that was significant. But it also isn't equal. It is separate and not equal. The mayor didn't have to have an emergency to imply the law in a manner that he deemed was necessary to meet the Constitution. Furthermore, if he had brought a debt relief action, aside from the issues that Your Honor raised earlier, which might have been questioned, the focus of that litigation would have been a suit between government officials who disagreed, instead of, as it has been in this case and in other cases that have come up before this court, a focus on the parties whose rights are truly affected, the parties who wanted to get married, the people who came to City Hall and sought licenses.
Ms. Stewart, let me turn your attention to the status of the parties who wanted to get married and turn your attention further to the parties who did get married. As you've heard me question opposing counsel, I ask, and a point that opposing counsel made, my interest is in why in this proceeding are we justified, or should we declare, as the Attorney General has asked, those marriages invalid, even if we agree with opposing counsel that the mayor had no authority to do what he did. One response I heard to my question that I'd like to hear you respond to is that these marriages had, they were invalid. There was no rational reason for a moment to believe that they were valid. Therefore, unlike marriages that the code declares a void or voidable, these marriages, according to opposing counsel, do not give the parties any due process right to be present in a proceeding declaring their invalidity or necessary joinder or a right for notice and opportunity to be heard. And I would like you to explain to me the difference between an invalid marriage where there's no such rights and a void marriage where there is.
Your Honor, under the law, I don't think there is such a distinction. The argument puts the cart before the horse. It would have the court almost reason in a circular fashion to say, well, the marriages are invalid, and therefore the parties don't have a right to come into court and argue why they should be valid and why the court should not invalidate them. But that's not the way due process works. If you have a claim, you are entitled to come in, or something that is going to directly affect your rights, you have a right to be before
but
the court.
But what if you have, as your opposing counsel said, no reasonable expectation that you had any right in this marriage?
I don't think the law holds that. There are many circumstances, Your Honor, in which cases have held that even where it appears on its face that a license or a permit may not have been properly issued or there may be something defective about it, the courts don't make that decision without having the parties before them.
Ms. Stewart, this brings me to a point, your, you know, understandable concern for the due process rights of couples whose marriages may be affected by our ruling. Going back to the separation of powers concepts that we've talked about previously and why it is appropriate perhaps for courts rather than persons in the executive branch to make determinations of unconstitutionality, the kind of due process that's afforded by courts in terms of notice, opportunity to be heard, to present evidence, minimal procedural safeguards in addition, were not afforded by the city officials in this case, were they, in making that determination of unconstitutionality? There wasn't the kind of proceeding which is authorized by our March 11th order, ceasing the issuance of marriage licenses here, but still permitting an attack in a judicial forum on the constitutionality. There was no such due process, was there, in the city officials' determinations that there was unconstitutionality. No notice. This came out of the blue. No opportunity to hear opposing arguments or sides. Isn't this somewhat inconsistent in terms of invoking the due process rights here of individuals affected by what may turn out to be invalid marriages and yet not having afforded any kind of due process in the city officials' initial determination?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. The city officials were acting as the executive branch officials that they are. They're charged with enforcing the marriage laws, among other many state and local laws that they enforce. In enforcing those laws, they look to see whether what they're doing is constitutional. It's part of their fundamental responsibility. Because of the major changes that had taken place in the jurisprudence in this area, they concluded that it was unconstitutional to deny licenses. They weren't denying rights, and they didn't deny anybody due process in basically refusing to exclude a group of people who historically had been excluded from a right that's a very important right.
Counsel, taking you back to another case, Perez versus Sharp, decided in 1948, in which our court, this court, found anti-miscegenation statutes to be unconstitutional with denial of equal protection. Is it your view that a county clerk prior to the issuance of that decision would have the right to issue licenses to people of different races?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
On what grounds?
Again, we cited in our brief about 100 years or more worth of cases in which local government officials, state government officials of executive branch have made constitutional decisions and declined to enforce state statute on those statutes on those grounds. There are a variety of statutes. In Denman, it was a municipal auditor, and you could call it the most ministerial function in the world. He was supposed to issue a check for the salary of a commissioner. He concluded that the state statute that authorized the election of that commissioner was unconstitutional and refused to issue the warrant. A writ of mandate was brought. My recollection is that the court agreed with the auditor. The court said that the auditor had the duty not to issue the check because it was unconstitutional. Denman, which is an 1896 case, is the first in a long series of cases. Golden Gate Bridge and Highway District was another one. The secretary of a bridge district similarly refused to issue bonds because the statute providing for the bonds was, in his view, unconstitutional.
But, Ms. Stewart, isn't it qualitatively different, to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, where local officials refuse to enforce or to implement a state statute and do so to bring the challenge, rather than the situation here, where, as the Attorney General pointed out, the real effect of this was to rewrite the marriage laws of California. And so my question is, don't you see a qualitative difference between an action where it actually brings the challenge into court and one where it, in fact, eliminates the role of both the court and the legislature?
Your Honor, I don't think Mayor did or intended to eliminate the role of the courts, nor was he successful if that was his intent. I don't think that in any of the cases that we cited that, in fact, what happened first was the local official coming into court. On the contrary, the cases I just mentioned and many others in which the court has not even touched on 3.5 or even raised the issue, municipal and state officials have decided that a law, a state law, is unconstitutional, have declined to enforce it, as the municipal auditor did in Denman, as the County of Riverside did with the statute requiring him to go to binding arbitration.
I understand. I wasn't suggesting that they went directly into court. I understand you're saying that there was a writ of mandate action. But the difference, as I perceive the Attorney General's argument, is that what he's arguing is that here the city official also created the remedy.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I don't think it plays out logically when you look at it. You could say that the auditor in Denman was rewriting the statute or writing it out of the law because he refused to pay the commissioner. The commissioner, as far as he was concerned, did not exist because the statute creating that position was unconstitutional. Likewise, in the County of Riverside, the county refused to go to binding arbitration. It chose its own remedy. It didn't go to arbitration. It basically said the statute won't be honored. It doesn't apply.
Do you think there is a difference between a public official acting to do something which relates to, say, self-governance or the local fisc or something of that sort, and taking a position when the application is to a statewide law?
Well, and in fact, Your Honor, in the Riverside case, the debate was whether the law governing the labor relations of sheriffs ought to be a statewide issue. I do think that one can argue there's a difference between whether an issue that the municipality is involved with has greater or lesser state implications. But I actually would suggest to the court that it is even more important when third-party constitutional rights are at stake that the government act to take a position to uphold the Constitution than in situations that are purely a matter of local power or local authority or some such as in County Riverside.
Well, let me explore that further and take you back to the hypotheticals that the Chief Justice gave you some time back. What if local officials, I mean, the scope of the Takings Clause, the Fifth Amendment, is debated. The scope of the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment is debated. What if local officials, in very good faith, determined that there was a right to bear arms and statutes or ordinances relating to weaponry were unconstitutional, or that to circumscribe a landowner's use of his property was unconstitutional and therefore access to a beach could be blocked and you could proceed to build. How does that differ from what happened here?
Your Honor, I don't think it does, and I think those situations arise with some frequency, and what happens is that if someone believes that the municipal actor was wrong, either the Attorney General or a party who's affected brings a writ of mandate. That's why we have a writ of mandate.
Let's just say a Los Angeles Superior Court judge had ruled that the state marriage statutes, family law section 300 and whatever, the following ones, are constitutional. Would the city officials in San Francisco, based upon their view of the Constitution, state and or federal, and the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in the cases you've cited and so forth, be justified in issuing licenses as they have to single-sex couples?
No, Your Honor.
Couples?
Marbury held that the judicial branch is the ultimate expositor of constitutional rights. We do not in any way, shape, or form suggest otherwise. In the end of the day, the courts make the decision, and all officials in both the legislature and the executive branch are bound by those decisions.
Of course, that's not a precedential decision. If we had a trial court decision in Los Angeles, might bind officials in that county, but certainly it's not precedent. But to what degree does the local official have to have this abiding belief in the unconstitutionality, and on what basis for it to prevail over our normal recourse to the judicial process for the resolution of that type of question?
Again, Your Honor, it is difficult to draw a line, and I don't think the cases do so. They simply address whether the official was right or wrong. But if the court is inclined to draw a line, I would suggest that the line is where there is sound or solid judicial support. Here we've got the Goodridge case, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, under that state constitution, which is very similar to our own. We've got the Lawrence case, which for all people have debated about it, very clearly stated that gay men and lesbians have the same right to autonomy in personal relationships, family relationships, marriage, procreation, etc., as heterosexual couples. You can't take that language any other way, as Justice Scalia pointed out. Or perhaps you can, but in any event, at very minimum, it is a sound judicial basis for what the mayor has decided here.
Well,
now,
why,
let
when
me
you're
ask
talking
you,
about criminal...
In terms of the authority of the mayor, is there any statutory authority that gives any mayor responsibility and authority in the area of marriage? Under the marriage laws?
Generally, Your Honor?
The statutes.
Sure. The Family Code Section 300 and 301 and following specify the procedure to solemnize and issue to issue marriage licenses. There are basically two or three prerequisites.
Yes, and it makes reference to the certain local officials who act under the supervision of the Director of Health Services in carrying out their ministerial duties. But I'm referring specifically to a mayor, not necessarily only this mayor, any mayor. Is there a specific statutory provision that even mentions the title mayor in the state marriage laws?
No, Your Honor. As far as I'm aware, there is not. However...
And my next question is there any such law as far as the charter for the city and county of San Francisco?
Yes, Your Honor. The charter of the city and county of San Francisco does two things. One, gives the mayor the authority to enforce all laws pertaining to the city. Secondly, gives the mayor responsibility to oversee the city administrator, who in turn bears the functions of the county clerk. So it is the mayor's direct line of authority to oversee the functions of the county clerk.
Is the county clerk obligated to follow the orders of the mayor?
Yes, Your Honor. If the mayor, the county clerk does not do so, she serves at the pleasure of the mayor, and she has to follow the directions.
But the county clerk has taken an oath of office to enforce the laws, and that's under oath. So if the county clerk disagrees with the mayor in terms of the mayor's interpretation of the constitutionality of the state marriage laws, I assume that the county clerk would be obligated to be true to his or her oath.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if the county clerk here had disagreed with the mayor, the county clerk might have acted otherwise, but the county clerk didn't disagree with the mayor, and the mayor directed her to act in a constitutional manner, or what he believed to be a constitutional manner. I want to also point out that there is nothing in the state statutes that gives any state officials authority directly over the county clerk.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Justice Baxter alluded to some of those statutes, and I think it also brings into play your response to some of the arguments that have been made about Article 3, Section 3.5. The Health and Safety Code, Section 10.2285, states that the county recorder is the local registrar of marriages and shall perform all the duties of the local registrar of marriages. And then a section not too far after that, 10.2295, says that each local registrar, meaning the county recorder, is hereby charged with the enforcement of this part in his or her registration district under the supervision and direction of the state registrar, and shall make an immediate report to the state registrar of any violation of this law coming to his or her knowledge. Now, what bearing does that have, and specifically on the fact that your opposing counsel urged that for this limited purpose of the enforcement of state statutes pertaining to marriage, these local officials in San Francisco are, in fact, state officers, state agencies?
Your Honor, the assessor, who's the combined in San Francisco as the assessor recorder, acts to record marriage licenses. Recording a marriage license is not an essential prerequisite to a marriage. It is something that creates a record of it for both health purposes and other purposes that the state oversees. Here we are concerned with marriages themselves, the validity of the marriages. The recordation of a marriage has no bearing whatsoever on its validity. There are only three prerequisites to a marriage. One is consent, the other is solemnization, and the third is a license. Whether or not it's recorded doesn't have any effect. It has an effect on your ability to prove that the marriage happened and that it was solemnized, but it is not a prerequisite to a marriage. So the issue of whether the assessor and the function of assessor recorder is subject to state supervision and control, and whether she may have been acting as an agent, is really beside the point, because the parties here who are at issue in the action that the Attorney General has been concerned about are concerned with issuing marriage licenses and solemnizing marriages, and recordation is icing on the cake. It really doesn't go to the functional validity of the marriage.
Let me ask you, Ms. Stewart, before your time runs out, somewhat related to that point. If this court should decide that the mayor had no authority to authorize or grant marriage licenses and record those marriages, and this touches on your last point about the three essentials to a marriage, if the mayor had no authority, would it not follow that the marriages were invalid?
No, Your Honor. There are many, many cases, and there is a particular family code section, Section 306, that provides that acts or failures to act on the part of a third party do not invalidate a marriage. So the only thing that can go wrong, if you will, in a marriage, that there are the circumstances like bigamy and like incest, which give rise to voidable or void marriages under family code sections 2210, there's a whole set of procedures that you have to go through, and parties who can sue to try to void or nullify a marriage under those procedures.
And you would say that a marriage between same-sex individuals would fall within that category of void marriages where procedures have to be adhered to in order to declare them invalid?
No, Your Honor. I would say that the legislature did not provide for voiding or nullifying marriages between two people of the same gender, and therefore did not intend to invalidate such to provide for nullification of those marriages.
Well, is it your position then, I should let you finish, but is it your position then that those marriages cannot be invalidated and that they are valid?
Your Honor, I haven't gone that far. What I have researched and concluded at this point is that the court shouldn't address that issue here. The question I think you're raising is if we, the court, hold ultimately that it is constitutional to exclude gay men and lesbians from the right to marry, can we invalidate the marriages? There is a debate about that.
Well, actually, that would be down the road. So what I really was asking was, and it's been touched on before, if this court were to conclude the mayor had no authority and nothing occurred was authorized, would it not be both logical and our duty to declare the marriage is invalid?
No, Your Honor. It would be prohibited by this court's prior decisions and by Section 306 of the Family Code, which provides that the failure on the part of a county clerk or a solemnizing official or any other official involved in marriage to carry out their part of the process or in some way to act in a way that is not proper doesn't invalidate the marriage.
Doesn't that deal with technical defects?
That deals with any kind of defect, Your Honor.
Does it mean that a marriage that is totally contrary to state statute is to be, you know, that invalidity is to be disregarded? I think there's a difference there in terms of the technical flaws that are dealt with that statute and the situation here.
Well, Your Honor, the best example of a case that actually arose that I can give you is the Argonaut case, in which the parties used false names on their marriage license, and the official, the city official, did not verify that they were who they said they were. The court refused to invalidate the marriage because of the strong public policy in favor of marriage. Not
there are cases where courts have found marriages void and declared them void outside the narrow categories of just the illustration set forth in the statutes.
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. You have to go through the process, but once you've gone through the process, so if you don't have a marriage license, you haven't gone through the process, and that's the Estate of DePoss case. But apart from that, I'm unaware of any case that is held that some ground not covered by statute will serve as grounds to nullify a marriage. And
so there has to be 4,000 whatever separate determinations? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor.
If the court were to declare that there was no authority?
I think the court could bring the parties in a class procedure or some other consolidated procedure to deal with the issue. But I do think they are entitled to notice and an opportunity to be heard and to make their arguments as to what the status of those licenses should be, both before the court should rule them invalid pending the proceedings or even if it ultimately decides the constitutional issue.
Well, wouldn't the issue arise also if one of these couples sought benefits that flow from marriage and those benefits were denied? The affected couple presumably would go to court and the issue would be resolved, and once it was, presumably it would be applicable to everybody else similarly situated.
Well, Your Honor, that could happen theoretically, but what I imagine is likely if, first of all, we're not aware of any such cases having been brought, doesn't mean it won't happen, but I would imagine that the courts would stay their hand while the substantive constitutional issues are being decided in the courts that already have jurisdiction over those issues, unless it were some type of emergency situation.
If we were to, contrary to your argument, if we were to declare, one, that the mayor had no authority, and two, that the marriages were invalid, and if later on a court, or maybe this court, were to say that restricting marriage to a man and woman was unconstitutional, what would be the status of the marriages that took place when that question was unresolved?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, if we declared them, as opposing counsel wants us to in this action, to be invalid, later, hypothetically, if the court were to say that the restriction on marriage was unconstitutional, would those marriages spring back into life, or would the couples have to be remarried? This is very hypothetical down the line, but
I think that's exactly the problem of the court going forward now to try to address the validity of the marriages. If it does so, it's essentially issuing an advisory opinion, and one that it's questionable whether it has jurisdiction to do in the absence of the parties.
Why would that be, given the fact that the argument here is not, and we made it very clear, and neither side wants us to determine the equal protection claims in this case, we made it very clear that the question is a question of the authority of local officials. So if, in fact, local officials did not have the authority to issue marriage licenses and to solemnize marriages of single-sex couples, then and that was because there had been no judicial determination that the statutes that apply are unconstitutional, then the fact that there's a later judicial determination would not seem to have any bearing, because the fact would be that these 4,000 marriages were performed without any judicial invalidation of the applicable state marriage statutes?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that the case law is fairly clear that such an issue as the authority of the official or the way that they act doesn't have a bearing. Family Code Section 306 very specifically says the acts of a third party don't invalidate a marriage.
Well, wouldn't that be just as if we invalidate these marriages and then the Leno Bill passes? That wouldn't revive the marriages that were performed this year, would it?
Your Honor, I'm struggling with the question because I'm not – the premise is that, if I understand it, is that the court invalidates the marriages.
If the court were to find that they were invalid and
let me address
later it. On a court finds that the statutes are unconstitutional, that wouldn't revive it any more than the passage of the Leno Bill would validate marriages issued this year, would it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, I think that points to the very real problem. If the court invalidates licenses now, let's assume you disagree with every argument I've made as to why you shouldn't and can't do that, and the court goes ahead and does that, it won't. The marriages won't spring back to life. And in the meanwhile, there are 4,000 couples. If there's a change in status of those couples, people could be deprived of the right to marry irrevocably because the fact that they may at some future point be permitted to marry, if one of them has died or been so injured that they lack capacity, that can't occur. Furthermore, the marriage, the time when you are married, serves as a marker, a placeholder of sorts. It determines when certain rights and obligations apply to you and your family. And by marrying when they did, those couples chose to make that commitment, to take on the obligations, to be subject to the rights, knowing there was uncertainty, to be sure, but hoping that the court would honor them and that ultimately local and public officials in the state government would honor them. So they entered into those relationships. And if the court holds they are invalid, it won't be the same to get married 2 years from now or 3 years from now or whenever this issue finally works its way through this court again.
Whether it's the same or not, and I have empathy for the situation that these people are in, perhaps you know, because of the doing of the city officials. The fact that it wouldn't be the same doesn't change the law, does it? Does it authorize something that was not authorized?
Well, again, I don't want to repeat myself, but if the court holds that the mayor and the county clerk acted without authority, I don't believe that is a ground for invalidating the licenses. The court may disagree, but that's our position. So I think regardless, the marriage's licenses should remain in effect. They should remain in effect at very minimum pending resolution through the trial courts and then up through this court of the constitutional issues.
And implicit in your argument is the fact that here the same-sex married couples are not before the court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And presumably another part of your argument is that because, as has been pointed out by the Attorney General as he started this argument, the constitutionality of the marriages in question is not before the court. Is it your view that this court should not deal with the validity or invalidity of the 4,000 marriages until that separate issue of the constitutionality of these marriages has been decided in the lower courts, first in the trial court and then in the court of appeal and then ultimately this court?
Yes, Your Honor, and until an action is brought that properly brings those parties in.
Before you leave that, how do you deal with the argument that not only are the couples themselves left in a legal limbo in terms of various rights, not only vis-a-vis domestic partnership laws, but tax, inheritance, employee benefits, and so forth, but their employers are left in legal limbo. Different local governments where they may move to or where they may have some contacts are left in limbo. So is the state, which has to process these licenses and contravention of authority. The federal government, I understand from the papers filed in our court, that the Social Security Administration is not recognizing a certain name changes, not taking other actions under federal law because of the failure to follow state law. Are these matters not of significance, although the other side certainly finds that they are of significance?
Your Honor, I won't say they're not of significance, but I believe that they are overstated in the sense that we don't have a rush of court proceedings. We don't have a rush of people. There's no evidence that people have run into various places trying to assert their rights. And moreover, there's a simple sort of two-part decision that the state on the one hand and certain employers on the other hand will need to make. Do we honor the licenses while the issue is litigated? Do we not honor the licenses? In either event, ultimately the issue will be resolved in the courts. We have had uncertainty in many other areas of our constitutional law for periods much longer than will likely be the case here. And the question is, what do you place as more important? The rights of the people, the constitutional right to marry existed when it existed. It doesn't exist when the courts declare it. Equal protection has been in our Constitution for a long time, and either they had a constitutional right to get married or they did not. The court shouldn't take that away on grounds of convenience or some confusion, especially where there's no showing of any kind of emergency where the world is, you know, going to collapse.
Little bit early to make that determination. I mean, this court's order just came down on March 11th, and everything has been put in a certain limbo by our action. But the question is, should that limbo be perpetuated another year or two at least?
Well, Your Honor, I just would suggest that it is the case that the trial court has indicated it will move swiftly in these cases, and the parties are definitely moving towards resolution at the trial court level at this court's invitation. I think that there will be a window. There will be a window of uncertainty. There's no way of avoiding it. I don't think uncertainty rises to the level of chaos or, you know, civilization coming to an end. I really don't. I'm sure there will be some frustrating questions, and I'm sure there will be courts that may have to face them and decide whether they can wait and decide until the final merits are decided. But I think if the court invalidates the licenses now, what it will be doing is signaling to the world and signaling to the couples involved that their rights to have their relationships recognized are not considered weighty enough by this court to outweigh such considerations as inconvenience and confusion. And I really don't think that's the message this court wants to send, especially not having had those parties before the court to make the argument for themselves.
But, of course, it's the city that created this mess. And I still haven't heard an adequate explanation as to why the city did not get a judicial determination of the correctness of its position before putting all these people in the precarious position they are now in. And I'd like you to address that issue.
And you may answer that question, but your time is otherwise. I'm sorry, you do have 2 or 3 minutes. I miscalculated. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I think I answered it earlier and perhaps not articulately, but basically I don't think it is the city that put the couples in this position. I think it is the Bowers versus Hardwick decision and a lot of other really unfortunate
But if the law is so clear, you have options. You can get an attorney general's opinion and act on an attorney general's opinion. You can secure a determination from a court. So if the law was that supportive, why not utilize it and get the and to get the correctness of your position set forth before individuals are placed into the position that they are?
Well, Your Honor, some have argued, I don't agree with them, that there wouldn't be a live or ripe dispute if that were to occur. But I would suggest 2 things. One, that in the cases that I cited earlier, such as Denman and going forward up to County of Riverside, the counties didn't wait. They did act on their constitutional belief because otherwise they're basically forced into a position of applying a law. They're the ones who have to carry it out and to exclude people when they think it's unconstitutional to do. But secondly, if they had done that, if they had come into court for a DEC relief action, the focus of the action would have been on the city and the state, or the city officials in between, amongst themselves, if it had been, for example, the mayor against the county clerk. Apart from all the arguments that would have been made about not a ripe controversy and so forth, the reality is the case would not have focused on the real people whose rights are at stake.
Well, Counsel, in order to avoid this problem in the future, why shouldn't we hold that Proposition 5 that was passed in 1977 applies to local officials?
Your Honor, is Proposition 5 Section 3.5?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Your Honor, I think there are several principles of construction that preclude the court from making such a finding. One is that the legislation was very clearly intended by the voters to address state administrative agencies. The language of the provision is administrative agencies.
Well, it was passed in response to our Southern Pacific decision.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The UC held the statute unconstitutional.
Correct.
And the branch of government that did not like that was the legislature. And Proposition 5 was unanimously passed out of the legislature.
Yes. And put before the voters. But what was put before the voters was a measure which, if the court looks at the ballot pamphlet, repeatedly refers to state agencies, stopping state agencies from interpreting, from refusing to enforce statutes on constitutional grounds. There's a strong principle of construction that we don't read into what the voters did more than what they in fact did. It's in this court's decision in Hodges, in which it said, we may not properly interpret an initiative measure in a way that the electorate did not contemplate. The voters should get what they enacted, not more and not less. What the voters here enacted was a provision that addressed a specific and narrow problem. Further, the narrow problem they addressed is an exception to a rule which has been in this state and in this country for centuries. Chief Justice Rehnquist said in the U.S. versus Morrison case that in the performance of assigned constitutional duties, each branch of government must initially interpret the Constitution. This court should not read broadly an enactment that clearly wasn't meant so broadly by the public when they adopted it and upend and overturn a principle of law that is something that has been with us for as long as it has, which is since this state has been a state and since this nation has been a nation.
But with reference to that quotation, isn't the function of the executive in making determinations of constitutionality whether to sign or veto proposed legislation? And the legislature looks at constitutionality in terms of whether or not to pass it. It doesn't mean that the legislature or the executive are authorized to engage in quasi-judicial determinations, does it?
No, Your Honor, but this was not a quasi-judicial determination. Any time an official in the executive branch must enforce a law, he or she has to make a decision of what the law requires, and that always, always involves looking to the Constitution first. In the case of the Sedition Act, Thomas Jefferson refused to enforce it because he believed it was unconstitutional. He directed the U.S. attorneys and the Attorney General not to enforce it, and he let everyone who had been convicted under that statute, he pardoned them. Sometimes the executive, in carrying out their function, must act. And in order to act, they have to act according to constitutional principle. That's not legislating. It's not acting judicially. There's always been an overlap in the powers of our three branches of government. That tension between them and the testing of constitutional principles is meant to be done at three levels. Ultimately, the courts decide. That's why we're here today. That's why we're in the trial court. And that's what will end up happening. And whatever decision is made, local government officials will be bound by it. But in the first day, in the first instance, in applying their function and carrying out their duties, they must first interpret the Constitution. And before this court turns that whole longstanding notion on its head, it should be very cautious and very restrained. And I don't think that's what Section 3.5 meant. I think there's ample discussion in our brief about the limits of Section 3.5 and what it was meant to do. The language is very plain. And with that, I think I'd better sit down.
All right, and your time is up. Thank you, Ms. Stewart. We'll now hear by way of rebuttal, first from Mr. Muscat.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the example provided by the Council for San Francisco, the President did not enforce the Sedition Act. That is true. But what the President did not do is rewrite the Sedition Act, come up with a draft that he likes, and then enforce that new version. And that is the fundamental problem that we have in this case.
Counsel, what did President Wilson do in the Myers case? Didn't he make a determination that the Tenure Act was unconstitutional and later was found to be correct by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Your Honor, I believe that's correct, but I'm not sure. I'm sorry.
So he made a preliminary constitutional determination that a statute was unconstitutional, later ratified by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Your Honor, we would certainly agree that there are examples of executive nullification where the chief executive officer, out of constitutional concerns, decides not to enforce a statute. We don't have an example of executive nullification here, but we have an example of the executive taking away the authority not only of the judiciary, but of the legislature in implementing a new statutory scheme that doesn't exist. An example that's quite pertinent here is if you look at the state of Vermont. In 1999, in Baker versus Vermont, the Vermont Supreme Court declared that there were constitutional problems with the definition of marriage under that statute. Today, you do not have marriages in Vermont because after that opinion was issued by the state Supreme Court, it deferred its judgment. It allowed the state legislature to remedy the constitutional issues, and the state legislature drafted a civil union bill. Now, we certainly do not agree with the argument that the marriage laws in California are unconstitutional. But if those laws were unconstitutional, it would ultimately be a legislative question, a policy question.
That issue,
question.
As you reminded this court at the beginning of your argument, the constitutionality of this particular statute is not before us, right?
That is absolutely
right,
Your Honor.
That leads me to another question. In your view, if we were to agree with the opposing side that the mayor acted properly, would that be setting a problematic precedent? For instance, suppose that we do say the mayor acted properly. Presumably, given that decision by this court, other local officials would then be free to say, as has been pointed out by the bench earlier, well, I don't like that particular ban on the guns. I strongly believe that it is contrary to the Second Amendment that gives the people the right to bear arms. And there are numerous other examples. Is it your view that in that circumstance there is no certainty as to the so-called rule of law? Because then laws passed by the legislature or passed by the people through the power of initiative would always be under great uncertainty depending upon the views of a local official.
We agree, Your Honor, and that's not just the position of the Attorney General's office. It's the position of the late Justice Stanley Mosk. In the Southern Pacific opinion that we cited in our brief and his concurring and dissenting opinion, he appropriately discussed the problems that could arise by what has occurred here in San Francisco. The first problem is you reverse the presumption. Under the law of California, the presumption is that statutes are constitutional, and the position that San Francisco is advocating that local officials can have the reverse of the presumption, that they are unconstitutional. And the second problem is the people of the state of California have the right to assume that their laws are going to be enforced. And if local officials are entitled to ignore statutes or redraft statutes, that is no longer occurring.
Do you distinguish between duties at the local level that are ministerial in nature as opposed to duties at the local level that are largely discretionary in nature? There's certainly a difference, at least in my view, between the responsibilities and authority of a local district attorney who may or may not conclude that a particular statute is or is not constitutional and make decisions accordingly, as opposed to someone whose responsibilities are strictly ministerial. And I'd like you to address that point.
The point is particularly pertinent in regard to our analysis of Article 3, Section 3.5. Certainly, if you have a local official who is acting either under his or her powers under the local ordinance or a state law that gives them a great deal of discretion, we're not asking the court to rule that Article 3, Section 3.5 would apply to a local official under those circumstances. But here the circumstances are quite dramatically different. You have a local official that is acting entirely under state law. They have absolutely no discretion in their enforcement of state law, and they're actually giving a state authorization, a state license. Under this fact pattern, Article 3, Section 3.5 does apply, and we're not asking the court to issue a decision that goes any broader than this fact pattern.
Now, you cite the case of Strumsky to support your position that Article 3 applies, but doesn't it say that it's inapplicable to government below the state level?
That is correct, Your Honor, and if the local officials were operating under local ordinances, we certainly would agree with the argument that the separation of powers clause does not apply. But again, under these facts, that is not true. They are not operating as local actors. They're operating as agents of the state because they're enforcing the delegated authority that's provided to them under the California Family Code.
Just as you don't want us to have the city, in your words, rewrite the Family Code statutes that limit marriage to couples of the opposite sex, I take it that we should not be rewriting Article 3, Section 3.5 to apply that to local officials if, in fact, they don't constitute, quote, an administrative agency.
We agree your argument to the extent that, again, local officials who are operating under their own local authority, under local ordinances, would not have to abide by Article 3, Section 3.5, and that's certainly not the argument we're making today. But if they're operating, again, under state law as state actors with no discretion, then they are a state agency for purposes of Article 3, Section 3.5.
Would the Director of Health Services come within 3.5?
Yes, Your Honor. The other point that I wanted to make, because it was brought up in regard to Family Code Section 306, we certainly agree that Family Code Section 306 can be used to cure technical defects that are caused by third parties. But what we have here is not a technical defect. We have a redefinition of marriage. And Family Code Section 306 can't be used to redefine the definition of marriage. And that's why that argument simply doesn't work for San Francisco. And if there are no further questions, the state submits. Thank you.
All right. Apparently there are none. Thank you, Mr. Muscat. We will hear now from Mr. Lawrence by way of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One additional point that I want to make about express preemption is that I don't think that I elaborated on was the altering of the applications and the marriage licenses themselves. That once again, even if it is true, which we do not concede, that the state marriage laws are unconstitutional, there is no authority that San Francisco has to rewrite the forms under Family Code Section 355 and others. It's clear that that is a state function, and they simply can't do that. They could have said, we can't do anything more under these unconstitutional laws. But again, it's a big jump for them to say, we think these laws are unconstitutional, and then we can rewrite them the way that we want. I think that essentially that's making an argument that this area of domestic relations law devolves from state legislative authority down to local units of government if they have the authority to rewrite the forms to define marriage however they want. I just want to echo the point that the Attorney General's office made, that 306 deals with technical defects. It doesn't give a blank check license to San Francisco to rewrite marriage laws however they feel. I do also want to comment on, just briefly, the San Francisco's argument that Zablosky and some of these other cases somehow overruled the Baker decision in Minnesota that we talked about earlier. Zablosky was a very different case, not about the definition of marriage, but about access to marriage. It was a case in which a man was behind in paying his child support, and Wisconsin had a law that says if you're behind in paying your child support, you can't get married, although you are otherwise eligible and meet all the qualifications under the Wisconsin marriage laws, which are essentially the same as California's. That what was struck down on a substantive due process right was the right for the that said the state had no authority to stick a barrier in front of somebody who otherwise could get married, and for something that was totally irrelevant to the definition of marriage, like they're behind in their child support. Zablosky does not address the issue of altering the definition of marriage like the Minnesota Baker v. Nelson case did. So there's not just a general right to get married to whomever you want, or else the United States Supreme Court would not have repeatedly rejected the lawsuits brought by the Mormon polygamists in the 1800s to redefine marriage. There's a clear constitutional principle there that there's a right to access to marriage, but that marriage is defined a certain way, not a right to rewrite marriage laws.
What is your response to the argument that the recent decision of the High Court in Lawrence versus Texas has eclipsed the Minnesota Supreme Court decision?
Well, there is the statement in there that counsel for San Francisco read about where they mention the word marriage. But there is the specific disclaimer that the court says that this case does not involve whether the government must give formal recognition to any relationship that homosexual persons seek to enter. And I think the reason was that Lawrence v. Texas is about a criminal law prosecuting people for private acts, as opposed to what we have here before the court, formal governmental legal recognition of a relationship that is basically one gets if you meet the conditions set up by the state. This isn't a right for individuals to redefine marriage however they want. This is why I think that there's a tone of inevitability that San Francisco gives to this, which I think is not accurate. I mean, it's not for this court to predict. But we do have the people who are ultimately the source of the Constitution, Hawaii and Alaska, rejecting court decisions finding a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Massachusetts, which has a slower constitutional process, is on the same road that may invalidate Goodrich and everything that we've seen going on in the last few weeks. The voters here, Proposition 22, even though it was a proposition and not a initiative to amend the state constitution, by a very strong majority, defined marriage as a man and a woman. The inevitability argument that somehow, therefore, you'll be faced with a situation of retroactively validating what San Francisco did is a day I do not think will ever come if the voters have a say in this. I may be wrong, but there is no clear evidence that this is somehow inevitable and never going to, that the laws are going to be changed. If there are no further questions, we ask this court to grant the writ of mandate, to also to and I'm being handed a note here to lift the stay on the Proposition 22 case so that it can participate in the coordinating hearing that is going on June 9th. That they are being prevented at this point or being hampered in some level, and they would like that to be lifted so they can participate in that. We ask this court to declare these licenses never been valid and that what the city did exceeded its authority under state law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Muscat, Ms. Stewart. The matter stands submitted.